Well, last time I saw you was about 5 years ago, 1983, I believe, and it was on the occasion of The World is Made of Glass.
That's right. That's
we
right.
talked about Jung and That's the young right. woman who went to Jung to confess murder.
That's right.
It was a terrific book.
That was a quite extraordinary book. It divided my readership very sharply. Men didn't like it at all. The people who read it and liked it were women. And we did try to do an analysis, a kind of Jungian analysis afterwards, and came to the conclusion that it was probably because men do not really believe in the wideness and variety of women's sexual fantasies. Women, on the other hand, understood the book perfectly.
Well, that was 5 years ago, so a lot of years have passed, and you've been busy. A lot of things have happened to you. Can you kind of bring me up to date?
Well, I guess that the principal thing that has happened to me, it happened 2 years ago, was having open-heart surgery at 72, which changed my life completely in the sense that I'd had a fairly rough year. I was writing a novel called Masterclass, which has not yet been published in the United States, but which I can tell you this morning as an exclusive has just been signed.
St. Martin's?
St. Martin's.
Congratulations.
And this was a novel that I was working on as a kind of diversion. I didn't want to write a serious book. I wasn't feeling very well, and I thought, oh, to hell with it. Let me write something that will divert me. I collect art. We have a reasonably good collection of Australian art with some Italian art. And I thought, I know a fair amount about this international art market. Why don't I write about it? I had finished the first draft of the book, and I was feeling more like a man of 72. And it took me a long time to get out of a chair. You haven't reached this stage yet, but the stairs get steeper and the roads get a little longer, and it takes a little longer to get out of a chair or really to reach for a glass or something like that, you see. And I was sufficiently bothered by it to think, nah, this isn't really right. So I went along to see my doctor after I'd finished the book. And my doctor said, well, you know, Morris, you lead a rather sedentary life, and you're not taking too much exercise. I notice you've put on quite a bit of weight, and, you know, what do you expect at 72? So I said, well, yeah, I expected something a little better than this. And I then had the presumption to say to him, would you call up the cardiologist and see if he'd run a check on me?
Did you have any pain, chest pain?
A little, but nothing dramatic, you know, like indigestion.
Yeah.
So he, as GPs are apt to do when laymen give them advice or make suggestions, said, well, if you feel that's a good idea, of course. So he rang the man, and that afternoon I went down, and he gave me the same thing. He's a younger man in his vigorous 40s, and he patted my head and patted my hand and took the cardiograms and put me on the exercise machine and said the same thing. Oh, 72, your sedentary life, all that sort of thing. And then he did a double take and said, tell you what I'll do. I'll put you into hospital on Wednesday and we'll run an angiogram. You can even watch it on television while we're doing it. We pump dye into your arteries and see what your arterial system is like, and I'm sure at the end of it you'll be fine. But it'll, you know, calm your fears and make you feel cheerful. Which he duly did. And he said, you'll know by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he came up and sat on the edge of my bed and said, cheerfully, do you want the good news or the bad news? Literally in those terms. And I said, well, give me the bad news. And he said, well, I have to tell you that the bad news is that you are going to have a massive heart attack very quickly. You could even have it this week, and you're going to die. It's going to kill you. And the good news is that we can fix it. And I said, how? And he said, well, with a bypass, it's a very normal operation now. I said, what are the odds? And he said, 8-2, 9-1. Now, the two and the one were the bothersome figures. You know, they're the ones where Dr. Sam Johnson, if you remember, said that the prospect of immediate execution concentrates the mind most wonderfully. So I went through this experience, and I must say that when I came out of it, I had solved at least part of one of the riddles of my Bible-oriented childhood, was that which was the Lazarus story. How did Lazarus feel when he came back from the dead? What had he seen? Did he welcome the gift of life? How did the world look to him? And that had haunted me since I was a child. Because, you know, in Bible class, Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, and that's a fascinating story, which we can perhaps talk about later. And I went through the experience, and then came out at 72 plus a few long days, with a new look at life altogether. The experience was quite profound, accompanied by enormous depressions, fragility of the emotion, a wonder whether I would be able to resume the thread of my normal existence, and the need to express this. I knew that I could not express it in autobiographical terms. I couldn't write a whole thing about I. Then I had been fiddling for a long time with the notion of rounding out the stories on the papacy, the shoes of the fishermen and the clowns of God, which had concentrated themselves into a final question. How do you unfreeze the power of an institution as represented by a man? You see, once you elevate someone, like a Gorbachev, like a Bush, like anybody, to a position of enormous executive power, you inhibit their personal growth. You presume that they are going to stop growing and be the perfect instruments in the position which they have assumed. Now, the fact is that they are, like all of us, imperfect people, but once you put them in power, they freeze. They freeze because there is little opportunity for development, because the inertia of the institution, to use a political term, the inertia of the American democratic system, with all its checks and balances, its relationships between the executive and Congress and the Senate, are all inertial things. They're like a huge stone. How do you shift them? How do you change what your predecessors have done? George Bush is in no position, for example, to criticize his predecessor or his predecessors. He can't enter into any of the historical debates about good or bad presidents. Same with the Pope. He's there. How does he change? And how does he change this enormous institution of more than a billion people who recognize his spiritual and indeed temporal power? And that was the final question. I guess, if you wanted to put it into popular terms, how do you convert a pope to Christianity? And having converted him to Christianity, how does he change directions within the church? Now, the most dramatic example of that, of course, of what could be done, was John the 23rd, who was elected as a kind of interim pope, didn't change anything in terms of the ceremonial, and he was still carried on the sedia gestatoria, and the fans still flapped about him, but he suddenly said, let us update the church, let us call a council, and let the mind of the church, Catholic, be once heard again. And that was a historic moment. then a freeze started again, because people, although they believe in the workings of the Holy Spirit, don't like to let the Holy Spirit work. They rather think that human beings can do better. They don't like to sit and hear the wind blowing.
So the premise of Lazarus, of course, is Pope Leo, who is very, very conservative, undergoes open-heart surgery and comes out. He sees the light after the surgery and moves to shift the backward theology of the Church. You're rather, for a good Catholic boy, you're rather hard on the Catholic Church in Lazarus, aren't you?
Yes. But remember, I am what you say. I'm a Catholic boy. I live within the community. I'm part of the family. I may be regarded in some quarters as a somewhat recalcitrant or even too vocal member, but I am a member. I'm a professing, communicating member of the Church, as I'm a professing, communicating member of a family. And you know what happens in a family? Somebody at some stage says, "Come on, Pa. That's not right. You're 20 years behind the times. You're upsetting this family. You're being too authoritarian. You're being too sunk in the mores of 20 years ago. You have to live with us as we are, members of the family." And I think that's a valid position.
Here locally, our local cardinal, O'Connor, is very conservative and is not about to change his stand. And in fact, he and a number of bishops recently decided to hire at millions and millions of dollars a high-powered public relations firm in order to sell the church's current standpoint, particularly with regard to abortion, which I thought was rather strange. It's using modern methods to protect old ways.
Yes, one wonders about the simplicity of the precursor, John the Baptist, and the man he announced, who came out of the desert in dusty clothes with straggly beards, rather lean and hungry, and stood on a roadside and said, "We have the message of God for you."
A couple of questions about the book. In the novel, the Pope is prepared for open-heart surgery, and there must be tremendous psychological trauma involved here. He's prepped. There's someone who's a specialist, a young woman who's a specialist in this. Can you tell me a little bit? This happened to you as well, is that correct?
Everything that is in the book about the preludes to and the aftermath of heart surgery is painted from the life, as it were, so that the details are very exact. The very strange part is waiting for your greeting by Brother Death, as it were. Now, what you find, and I found this with the majority of the people with whom I was associated in the hospital, fellow patients, because you are encouraged to be mutually supportive, having joined this very exclusive club, that the thing that people fear about dying is not dying. You are prepared for that. You have a built-in preparation for that. It is the unknown manner of your passing that frightens you. Now, once that fear is overcome, once that moment is overcome, once that commitment is overcome, the contemplation of what exists on the other side of the paper hoop is strangely peaceful. I'm going to tell you something fairly intimate at this moment. I had, my wife said to me, "Would you like the priest to come and see you?" And I said, "Yes, fine." Now the priest came and gave me the last rites of the church. And when he'd gone, and that's my last contact, as it were, with anybody that can help me in any fashion. So I'm lying there in the dark, and I'm thinking, well, that was appropriate, as it were. I've lived in this community. I die in this community if I'm going to die. And that's fine. But in a certain sense, it was redundant. Whatever subsisted between me and the Creator, and I had not then, nor do I have now, a name for the Creator. But I had the absolute conviction that whatever was between me and the Creator, creature and Creator, was already settled. It was a relationship that I could trust. It's like as if one held a butterfly or a small bird on the hand, and so long as you didn't move the hand, the butterfly would stay there.
One thing that struck me is we all view the Pope as next to God, but everyone seemed to be quite assertive in addressing what they felt the Pope in this book should do. Stay as you are, change, even the young Danish woman, Danish, I believe, right?
Yes.
The therapist says, sit down, I'm going to tell you what you have to do, but I'd be afraid to do it. I mean, just don't talk to the Pope like that.
Well, even popes have to learn, and they do. I can remember Pius XII, who was the last of the princely popes. You may remember that in Cardinal Spellman's day there was a wax image of him over in St. Pat's. As you walked into the cathedral, Cardinal Spellman had a life-size wax image and put him in a glass case so that you walked in and there was that, while he was still alive. Now, that was a kind of moment of aberrant adoration, if you like. But cardinals are the people who elected the Pope. They are his college of advisers, supporters, and administrators. And it is their job to be as open as they dare with the man. Now, Pius XII was a man a little difficult to be open with in those days when it was still a very princely court. Well-founded legend said when he telephoned anybody in the Vatican, he said, Qui Pacelli, this is Pacelli. And the man on the other end of the phone dropped to one knee and said, Si Santita, yes, holiness, and waited for the heavens to fall. Not too far from the truth. There is no sense of democratic loosening up within the Vatican circles, but the man who is sitting there has to be told. And the one that can tell him, no man is a hero to his valet.
Or wife.
Or wife.
Now, you were a Christian brother as a youth in Australia. That was an unhappy experience for you, wasn't it?
Well, looking back, I was born into what was then an Irish ghetto. As in the early days in Boston, America, where the Irish migrants came, there were advertisements in the papers, no Catholics, no Irish, no Jews need apply. And that happened here too. So that the immigrant communities, and notably the Irish, because we were a large and fecund tribe, grouped together, and we had a very strong archbishop, a man called Daniel Mannix, who had come from Ireland and fought a man that I worked for later, the then Prime Minister of Australia, over conscription of the Irish to fight the battles of Britain. All these things were part of my youth. I was educated by the Christian Brothers, and they pursued a recruiting drive, you know, for young men to join the congregation and become teachers, and I did. They took me in at 14, which was pure cradle snatching. And I stayed in until I was 26, making annual vows. And when I came to the time when I had to make my vows in perpetuity, by then I had reached the conclusion that I was not made to be a monk. And so I left. And I lost a large part of my youth.
It was a rather regimented society, wasn't it?
Highly regimented, not merely highly regimented, but, strangely enough, for a teaching order, anti-intellectual. It was not like the Jesuits. The frontiers of inquiry, the frontiers of of information were very, very rigidly controlled. I can remember until I was finally professed, I was not supposed to read a newspaper. So that all the information that I was supposed to dispense to my charges was coming from textbooks. Approved textbooks, of course. My view of the Spanish War was dominated by the total right wing, who were perfectly sure that the dictator, El Caudillo, you know, was the messenger of God wiping out the communists. Now, that was a very restricted society. When I left, of course, the Pacific War was on, and I taught for a month or two in the state schools, and then went into the army. And I found that much less restrictive.
26, were you?
26.
26 when you, well, you don't seem the worst for wear as a result. I mean, you're an intellectual, a writer, an artist.
I was very fortunate. Looking back, I got a marvelous education. I was lucky to have the last of the old classical teachers who really taught me the unities of knowledge. And also the disciplines of study and work. Now, I could have done without some of that, I have to tell you. I could have done with a little more time for normal sensual enjoyment. But in point of fact, looking back, I was very lucky. I got what no university in the world could have given me, that kind of disciplined study. And when I came into Europe many years later for the first time, as a layman and married and whatever, I was suddenly in a country I knew everything about. Well, not everything about, but I said, this is familiar to me. I had learnt, had a reasonable grounding in most of the Latin languages, so that though I couldn't speak it, I could read Spanish and I could read Catalan and I could even read Romanian in those days. And so this whole civilization of Europe, and even the historic background of Europe, made sense to me. I was not a stranger. And that was a marvelous opening of this pent spirit of mine. So that when I came to Italy, it was a love affair.
How long did you live in Italy?
The longest time we lived was 7 years.
What were you doing there at the time?
Originally, I went there to write a book.
Was that Shoes of the Fisherman?
No. When I sold my first book to the United States, it was a book called Kundu, about New Guinea, which was basically a novel full of the tales which had been told to me by an old missionary with whom I travelled on a Greek ship. And I wrote this book and sold it to then Dell Publishing Company as a paperback. It was sold by a man whose name is still revered in the agency world, the late Paul Reynolds, for $1,750. And with that magnificent sum in my pocket, Joy and our 18-month-old son set sail on this old Flotolauro tub, travelling first class, but it was an old migrant ship, to Naples. And we landed there at the end of January, and I said to Joy, we were theoretically going on to England, and I said, why don't we stay here for the spring? And this would be a marvellous place for me to start this new career of mine, because then I'd been a radio producer, you see, with Rupert Murdoch's father, or for Rupert Murdoch's father. And so, foolishly, we got off the ship, and the CIT people found us a tiny little villetta, which was just a concrete box in Sorrento, and we drove down there to establish ourselves and make me a romantic writer. What we didn't know, of course, is this had been the most brutal winter in 20 years. There was snow on Vesuvius, the orange trees were wilting, even the olives, which are pretty hardy things, were dropping their fruit, and there was great poverty. And this tiny little concrete box was unlivable. So, we gathered up our belongings and walked back to a hotel which we'd seen along the road, an old Edwardian hotel called the Hotel Cocumella. Cocumelo really means a big egg-shaped tomb, which they had discovered under it. And it was an Edwardian hotel where the British used to come down with their parasols and their bustles and holiday in the sun. They took us in for the night, and we discovered that it was run by an American woman whose name was Alison Dix Gargiulo. She had married an Italian, and the family were part proprietors of the hotel. So she said, "I have a little villa down the road. I can put you in there for a few months." Fine. The villa was on the road called the Via Califano. Now, Califano was the man who wrote Come Back to Sorrento. So it's beginning to get romantic, you see. Our money is running out, but it's fine. She gets us a maid called Tina, who was a fisherman's daughter, whose husband was in jail for murder, was likely to stay there for the rest of his life. And she had a little girl by an English soldier. So this becomes part of our household. Tina then proceeds to take over our lives and gets us a tame beggar who sits outside the gate every day to get his 100 lira, and a tame coachman with a starveling horse, and also a starving family who comes every morning to collect the other 200 lira to take the signora shopping. So we have an introduction to this life, but I have no theme for a book. I hear all about Goethe and Shelley and Lady Hamilton and the whole bit, but I don't find a book. And one day, Joy came to me with a newspaper with some photographs in it of one Don Mario Borelli, the priest who went down and lived on the streets of Naples with the urchins. Literally slept on the streets with them and pimped with them and sold. And then finally, like the Pied Piper, brought them into a ruined church and set up a home for them, which still exists. And she said, "There's your story." So I went across the bay on the ferry, and I met Mario Borelli and his little band of Pied Piper kids, and they introduced me to the life of the streets, and I wrote the story of this priest. Sent it off to London, and several weeks later, when we were just about starving, and I just had enough money to get to England to try and hustle the English agents along. That's another story I must tell you one time. The book became a succès d'estime. Mrs. Roosevelt happened to be in London the time it was published and took up the book and the cause of the urchins.
Yeah, the title of the book?
Children of the Sun.
Yes. Yeah.
It was published here by Doubleday. It didn't have the same impact as Children of the Shadows.
Mm-hmm.
But it made an enormous impact through Europe and England and Australia. And as a result of that, the BBC invited me to be a guest panelist on their Panorama program. Their invitation was, "Well, you did terribly well last night, and there's something about that strange Australian accent of yours might be rather attractive. Would you like to work for us?" So, as a result of that first appearance, which had to do with Children of the Sun, the Daily Mail asked me would I like to go to Rome and write a series on the Vatican, Vatican Finances. And in those days, the Vatican didn't even admit there was such a thing as finances. That was all handled between the Pope and Cardinal Spellman. And so I accepted to go, and that was the beginning of my career as a Vaticanista.
Well, we're almost out of time, Morris West, but tell me a little bit about the papal trilogy. I kind of hate to call it a trilogy because there may be more in the wind, yes. But how does Lazarus fit in logically with the other two books?
The first book was proved to be a prophetic book. This was the projection of the election of a Slavic pope. It began with a simple thought: how does the world look to a man who says he sees it with the eye of God? That's where the pope is. And I based it upon a character who was then in jail in the gulags, Cardinal Slipke, and on the principle that if they let him out, he would be made a cardinal and therefore could be elected to be pope. That was the thesis, and it had a certain inbuilt logic. I wrote the book in 1963. I was up on the borders of China, and my wife cabled me and said, Slipke is out and has been made a cardinal. 15 years after that, John Paul II was elected, and he came from the same place as Slipke. The correspondences were extraordinary. That was the first book, What Would Happen? The second book arose out of a visit to the United States at a historic moment where one Jerry Falwell had been on the air with the President of the United States. It was a large public occasion, if I remember, in an auditorium, where he said something like, and if the circumstance should ever come that the President is forced to drop the bomb, that for the believer will only bring the day of the Lord closer. Do you have a memory of this?
Vaguely.
Yeah. Vaguely, yeah. Now, that recalled to me, of course, the fact that I, as a Roman Catholic, every day at Mass, recite, Christ died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. The second coming is the oldest doctrine in Christianity. And the early Christians lived under the immediate shadow of it. You know, that the second coming is almost here, so be prepared for it. A couple of thousand years have passed, and I ask myself, what would happen if a reigning pope suddenly said, this is a fundamental doctrine of the Church and I must preach it and revivify people's belief in it? They'd probably have his head. And that was the thesis of the second book, where they engineered his deposition, as they had deposed Pope Celestine. And the third one was, okay, the man who engineered that and became the Pope then became a rigid reactionary who was going to protect the Church against all this nonsense which was theoretically tearing it apart. And he was the man who got the heart attack.
Yeah, I can see how they can fit in logically. You, as a Catholic, have raised issues in Lazarus about the Church and its conservatism. What would you do to, let me rephrase that, how would you change the Church to bring it forward?
The fundamental change which is necessary is in attitude, and that is that people need to address themselves to God in an atmosphere of compassion and of love and of care, not by fiat. You will do this, you will do that, you must do that. Man's relationship with God is one of sonship, daughtership, familial. We are the children of God. We are not people under the thumb of other people. The true title of the Pope, the real title of the Pope, the one which is least used, is servant of the servants of God. And that whole attitude that the Church belongs to the clerics is a historic madness based on imperialism.
Well, what about specifics? Would you take away the celibacy in the Church? Would you allow a choice of abortion and birth control and this sort of thing?
Let me be very clear on this. If you say, what would I do, that's a practical question. But if you say celibacy of the clergy, I have no objection to receiving the word of God or the sacraments from the hands of a celibate or a married person, man or woman. The gospel is the same. Now, as to whether any given line is acceptable or desirable or manageable at that moment, that's another question. That's a practical question. On the question of abortion, you have to remember that the whole notion of Christianity is one of willing submission of the individual to the revelation of God, right? Now, that also involves a free choice. In the truest attitude to Christian doctrine, I have a choice. I have a choice whether I can kill my brother and get away with it, whether I can commit adultery with the girl next door and get away with it. That's fine. The consequence, however, of my doing that is a breach in fundamental relationships. But suppose I do. Suppose I choose either one of those. I do not renounce, or I may renounce, but other people cannot renounce their relationship to me of love and compassion and my need for it. And what happens when all too often in this vast organization of ours is that people are teaching the faithful, this is right, that is wrong. The faithful know it. The faithful know it. What they need is, if you do wrong, it will have baleful consequences in your life. But the mercy of God and the grace of the community of the faithful is still yours at hand. And that is what we need in this community. Not more directions, not more commandments, not more, certainly, advertising agencies.
Just to wrap things up, just a question about yourself. You look terrific. I mean, you're not overweight.
Thank you for those kind words.
I mean, after the open-heart surgery, I imagine there are psychological scars, but you're still the storyteller you always were. Were there really fundamental changes in your outlook?
Yes, there were. I've become very, very tolerant.
Intolerant?
No, tolerant.
Oh, tolerant.
Very tolerant, very grateful, and I wake up each morning and every day is absolutely new. I'm aware of all the risks of life and how fragile is my hold on it, but I'm perfectly happy having once made the act, and this I guess was the real act of faith, of saying, I don't know what's on the other side. I have no more idea now than when I was a child of who God is, or basically what God is. But I accept to live in mystery, and I accept to live with gratitude in mystery.
Morris West, thank you very much. Another winner, Lazarus. Morris West, thank you very much.
Thank you.